Hello and welcome to a masterclass in Mariology. This is Dr. Mark Miravalli. I am joined by my dear friend and colleague, Dr. Robert Festigi, holder of about half dozen chairs in different areas, but certainly a chair of systematics at Sacred Heart Major Seminary, as well as having been the past president of the Mariological Society of America, the editor of Ott and Denzinger, and the list goes on and on. So Robert, thanks so much for joining us. Your contribution is, of course, invaluable to a masterclass.
My pleasure and my honor, Mark. And thank you for all you're doing for the Blessed Mother and for the Church.
We thank God. So in this program, we are going to discuss specifically the call for a fifth Marian dogma. Now, for those who have heard this topic before, hang in there, because we're going to take this from a slightly different angle. We're going to talk about, you know, why does the Church define dogmas to begin with? But then we're going to go through a brief summary of these three titles of co-redemptrix, mediatrix, and advocate, talk about what perhaps is the best genus and how it could theoretically be defined. And then we're going to talk about pros and cons as objectively as we can. We're both fairly known for being pro, but I think we can do the ad contra references and bring forward objections and respond to those in an aspect of seeking to give the fullest truth regarding these dimensions of Our Lady. So let's start, Robert. And again, I should also say we have individual masterclasses on each of these titles: co-redemptrix, mediatrix of all graces, advocate, as well as Our Lady's spiritual maternity. Again, in this program, we're going to try to put those together and to discuss what a potential definition may look like. But Robert, let's start with the fundamental question of why any dogmatic definitions. I mean, why did Pius IX define the Immaculate Conception in 1854? Pius XII with the Assumption in 1950. What's the purpose? What's the service of a solemn definition?
Yes, exactly. Well, we think of definire means to like set limits, but it also means a clear expression of what we believe, what has been revealed by God. Now, so when the Church makes a dogmatic proclamation, she's clarifying that this is a truth revealed by God, and not just believed by some pious people, and not just taught, here and there by the Church, but this is something that has been revealed by God, and we should accept with gratitude this deep truth. So sometimes a definition comes about because of petitions. The faithful say, well, why don't we just make this clear? For example, like with the Assumption, clearly there was a feast of Mary's Assumption or Coimesis or falling asleep, but it was really about her being lifted up to heaven, body and soul. And this was celebrated. But then there were people saying, let's make this clear. Let's define it. And so there was this Assumptionist movement, and so many petitions came, I mean, millions of them, you know, from the faithful. And so Pius XII eventually acquiesced, or he prayed about it. And he also consulted the U.S. bishop, not the U.S. bishops, all the bishops of the world, and said, I'm thinking of proclaiming this. Mm-hmm. He didn't have to do that, because of what Vatican I has taught, the Pope could proclaim a dogma without the consent of the Church because of his special charism. But he decided to do that, as did Blessed Pius IX with the Immaculate Conception. Mm-hmm. In other words, to make clear that this is a truth of the faith, that after the course of Mary's earthly life, she was assumed body and soul into heaven. And with the Immaculate Conception, after centuries of discussion and sometimes controversy, and even doctors of the Church like Saint Bernard of Clairvaux and Saint Thomas Aquinas stopping short of affirming Mary's Immaculate Conception, the doctrine developed and developed, And then there were prohibitions about ever writing articles disputing it, even though you weren't required to believe it. And then a feast day promoted by the Pope in the early 18th century as universal. Finally, what the church was praying was then dogmatically proclaimed. And also, in a certain sense, Our Lady's appearance at Rue de Bac in 1830 and the prayer which the bishop approved, O Mary conceived without sin, pray for us who have recourse to thee. Then there was a flood of petitions, please proclaim this, so there's no doubt. So I think that's one purpose of a definition. Yeah. Sometimes it's needed to, like at an ecumenical council, to resolve a doctrinal dispute, like at Ephesus in 431, that Mary truly is Theotokos, the one who bears God in her womb, and the Mother of God. So sometimes definitions are needed to resolve disputes, but other times things are believed and taught by the ordinary magisterium, but then people don't know that it's a truth of the faith.
Yeah, Robert, so many good points that you bring up here. And let's go after them in no certain order. Let me start with the private revelation dimension. I find that to be fascinating and true historically. Look, proclaiming dogmas is big business. It's historic business. And so it shouldn't be surprising that a private revelation can give us a certain confirmation to a Holy Father to make a proclamation. And it's not the foundation. It can never be the foundation. That's got to be scripture, tradition, and the magisterium. But confirmations, yeah, that's fair game. And so it's also known that a child French mystic went before Pius XII and said to the Holy Father, you know what you must do. And this child mystic died at 13, but he also gave the Pope encouragement for proclaiming the Assumption. But let's get back also to, so I think that's a very important thing. So we should not be surprised at the point that private revelations would encourage a papal definition. That's history. That's not novelty. And we've got, you know, a good half dozen today that have encouraged a papal definition of our very subject, Our Lady as our spiritual mother, inclusive of her roles of corredentrix, mediatrix, and advocate. But let's go back also to your great distinction about the whys. There's two predominant reasons. One, as you mentioned, places like Ephesus, to settle a controversy. The other is just to add clarity. I remember the line of Blessed Pius IX when he said that a dogma is the perfection of a doctrine. That is to say, it's already a doctrine officially taught by the magisterium. And so we have to remember our categories, that a doctrine is a truth about faith and morals, the truth of which is guaranteed by the magisterium, but has not been defined. Whereas a dogma, a solemn dogma, not more via the, you know, as the council says, everybody, a universally held belief, but a solemn proclamation, a specific proclamation, that's also something that happens for the sake of greater emphasis. It's almost like the Pope having a papal highlighter and saying, yeah, I want to highlight this doctrine. It's already a doctrine, and that's why it's so important, as we'll talk about in this program, that corredentrix, mediatrix, and advocate, they're already doctrinal. That means they've been taught by the popes for centuries. So the question is it the right time? And you bring up the petitions, which I also appreciate, because in point of fact, there have been more petitions for what we're going to talk about today than any other petition drive in the history of the Catholic Church. Now, to be fair, we're also in a more modernized age, so it's easier to get, you know, signatures or petitions, and we have internet. At the same time, we have well over 8 million petitions in less than 25 years, and that's just the count that the movement has. At a certain point in 1998, we said, well, don't send them to us, send them directly to the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith. So it's more than likely that they have several other millions of petitions in the last 20 years. So these are all legitimate factors of the issue of appropriateness. You know, is it appropriate? The doctrine should be clear because it's already taught officially by the magisterium. The question is it the right time for this proclamation? So, you know, in that light, you can see that the popes don't do this willy-nilly, so to speak. I mean, there's only four dogmas regarding Our Lady in the whole history of the church. But none of those four dogmas, and I think this is really a critically foundational point, none of those dogmas deal, Robert, with Our Lady's relationship with humanity. And so it's almost a great omission if you, at this stage, to say you've got dogmas about Our Lady's prerogatives in and of herself, given by the Father, her in relation to Jesus, but not about her role as mother to us in the order of grace, what the church so consistently teaches.
Exactly. That's very important. I mean, we now have an obligatory memorial of Mary as mother of the church. And there were even times where some people wondered whether that was an appropriate title, and it wasn't explicitly affirmed by the documents of Vatican II, but then St. Paul VI proclaimed it on November 21st, 1964, that Mary, we must all honor Mary as mother of the church. Well, what does it mean to be mother of the church? The church consists of human beings in need of salvation. What does she do as mother? So even that proclamation and that obligatory memorial need greater expansion, because I think as a mother, what does she do? As Vatican II Lumen Gentium 62 said, see, you know, taken up to heaven, she did not leave aside her maternal duty, but by her constant intercession continues to bring us what? The gifts of eternal salvation. So she has this mediatorial role. If she's bringing us the gifts of eternal salvation, that's a kind of active mediation of grace. So there are these wonderful papal encyclicals that affirm Mary as the dispensatrix of all graces, the mediatrix of all graces. And these are not minimal, a secondary, let us say, marginal magisterial documents. These are papal encyclicals by outstanding popes. Well, every pope has the authority, of course. But I mean, we have, you know, Leo XIII, Pius X, you know, and Pius XII. And then we have John Paul II about nine times affirming Mary as mediatrix of all graces, and Benedict XVI and Pope Francis affirming the title.
You're absolutely right. I have to confess that some of this is brought forth, you know, in light of a recent document by the DDF, by the Dicastery for the Doctrine of Faith. It was a statement on Rosa Mystica. Basically, you know, with the new norms, it can't say that it's approved, but it can basically, it gave it its own nihil obstat. But in that document, rather surprisingly, and I think unfortunately, it seems to say that, you know, that Mary does not have an active mediatorial role in the distribution of graces. Well, you know, Robert, when things like that happen, then you have to put three centuries of papal encyclicals, as you just articulated, up against one disciplinary, you know, thing by an author in a dicastery, and you have to realize that the popes win. Three centuries of papal teaching win, that Mary indeed mediates each and every grace of the redemption. And that's been papal teaching from Benedict the 14th in the 18th century, all the way up to Pope Francis, who just affirmed it last year by saying it's the most a venerated ancient title, mediatrix of all graces.
Exactly. I mean, what we could be happy about is that these messages, these apparitions to Parina Gili have been said not to be contrary to faith and morals. And I mean, it's so clear that, you know, Mary said in 1947 to Parina Gili, I am interposed as the mediatrix between humanity, particularly the religious souls, and my divine Son, who, tired of the offenses continually receives, wishes to exercise his justice. But then she also says, you know, after I was assumed into heaven, I am interposed as the mother mediatrix between my divine son and all of humanity. I mean, this is mediation of all graces. Now, it's a private revelation, but at least the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith said it is acceptable. Then they try to say, well, it has to be understood in according to Lumen Gentium 62. But Lumen Gentium 62, as we've just read, tells us that Mary did not lay aside her salvific duty, but by her constant intercession, continued to bring us the gifts of eternal salvation. Now, certainly the graces of eternal salvation were merited by our Lord Jesus Christ as the Redeemer. But so many popes have said that that she is the supreme dispensatrix, the one who dispenses these graces, or Pius the X in his 1904 encyclical Adeum Illum cites the image of St. Bernard of Clairvaux, that she's the supreme aqueduct of grace. Well, that's a form of mediation.
All right, yes. Well, yeah, it certainly is. And
grace, but she distributes, she communicates the grace.
Right. And why does she do that? Well, because of Lumen Gentium 61, which says that she had a unique role with Jesus in the restoration of supernatural lives for souls, period. For this reason, comma, she is a mother to us in the order of grace. So that's a clearly causal statement. And of course, our Lord merits infinitely. But Mary, as Benedict the 15th says, we may rightly say that Mary redeemed the human race together with Christ. That's an apostolic letter. And so she is co-redemptrix. And to get back to our focus here, we've delved into the second aspect, but let's go to the first aspect of her spiritual maternity, which is her co-redemption. And let me say, you know, Robert, there's many ways that this could be formulated. I personally think both for doctrinal clarity and also for receptivity from the faithful, that spiritual maternity is your best Janus. And let me just say a word of why I think that's the case. So for example, one could say, well, no, you should define co-redemptrix and then the effects of co-redemptrix, mediatrix and advocate, because that's first. There's merits to that as well. Others would say, well, no, mediation is your Janus category, because any interplay between Jesus and humanity comes through Mary. And so you want to use mediation. But I think if you want the combination, for example, if you ask someone off the street, a good Catholic off the street, explain Mary as your spiritual mother, they'd probably jump in. But if you said, well, explain Mary as mediatrix, well, that might be a little bit more challenging for them. They're essentially the same truth. So for that reason, I think both for accuracy, but also for understandability, to almost invent a term, for comprehensiveness, that the Janus of spiritual maternity is the best. And then the question is, how does she exercise that spiritual maternity? And I think she does that in these three principal ways. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, whether you see that as a positive definable format, or whether you think another format is preferable.
No, I think that's admirable, and I think it's true. You know, to stress her spiritual maternity, as I said, when she's mother of the church, she's exercising spiritual maternity. And this was a major theme of St. John Paul II. And it's there in Lumen Gentium 61. She's Mater Nobis in Ordine Gratiae. She's our mother in the order of grace. And then what the three titles explain, that they help to explicate what she does as spiritual mother. Well, she became our spiritual mother because she cooperated in the work of redemption. I mean, as Pope Francis has said, there's no salvation without the woman. Mm-hmm. And so Benedict the 15th saying, we could rightly say that she, you know, she together with Jesus redeemed the human race. because we would not have the Savior and his blood without her mediation. So in other words, we see her as the one who objectively cooperated in the work of redemption, and then who, taken up to heaven, continues to mediate for us the graces of redemption, which Lumen Gentium 62 explicitly affirms. And then she's our mother. What does a mother do but plead for her children, intercede for her children? All of this is her role as advocate, the one who comes to our defense, who helps us. Now, one objection maybe is this, and you know it comes from an Italian Mariologist, Salvatore Perella, Father Perella. He says, well, no, these are three separate titles and activities of Our Lady. They're not all, you shouldn't combine the three. You've responded to that several times, Mark. Maybe you could elaborate on how you would respond or how you have responded to the good Father Perella.
Yeah, surely. I would almost get very concrete and say, well, you know, when as a child, when Father Perella's mother suffered for him, and then when she cooked some good pasta for him, and when she came to his defense from some tough kids in the region of southern Italy, did he have three mothers? No, he had one mother. And she did those three functions, all those three functions. And so to separate a mother suffering from a mother nourishing would seem to me to be an artificial separation. Distinction, fine. Separation, no. These are the different modes of how Our Lady acts precisely as mother. So to say, well, she's not really a mother to me when she's feeding me or when she's forming me or educating me, but she is when she's defending me or she's interceding so I can get this scholarship, I would see that as rather weak and artificial. I think it's much more true of motherhood and much more true of Our Lady to say one mother, three aspects, not three mothers or three separate entities. Again, distinct, but not separate.
Exactly. And I could think of a comparison to the truth of Mary's threefold virginity. She's a virgin before giving birth, in giving birth, and perpetually after giving birth, but it's all the same virgin mother, but it's like looking at three modes or aspects of her perpetual virginity.
I think that's a great example, Robert, and I think it's very relevant to this. So if we're going to go to co-redemptrix, and again, we've done a whole masterclass on this, but let's just focus on let me back up even still and say doctrine is referring, the title is referring to a doctrine. The title is a function. These are not just honorary titles. These are referring to spiritual actions of the mother. So co-redemptrix is a single word that denotes Mary's unique participation with and under Jesus in the redemption of humanity. And what screams out to me, and I called it out at this London conference recently, which, by the way, was packed with co-redemptrix supporters. I was very happy to see it. In fact, one gentleman who teaches at a couple places said that he includes on his final exam, do you think it is the right time for a fifth Marian dogma? And he finds that all the students respond yes, obviously based part on his training. So, you know, these are not invented momentum references. These are really taking place. But I said, you know, could we just kind of identify the metaphysical elephant in the room? And that is participation. All of this depends on participation. And so, for example, when you have a document, again, this is a disciplinary document by the DDF. I don't personally think that Cardinal Fernandez wrote it himself. I think it's more typical, or at least oftentimes the case, that other, you know, theologians, people write this. But when you say that only Jesus distributes graces, you're forgetting Mary's participation in everything that Jesus does. It's not Our Lady on her own, but it is her participation in this mission of salvation. And depending on whether you go moral instrumentality or you go physical instrumentality, which many of the greats, De Montfort, Colby, Bernardine, say that Jesus gave Mary a real jurisdiction, a custodianship of graces. So she distributes them as she wills, to she wills, when she wills. Now, why would Jesus do that? Because A, there's no fear of the Immaculate Conception going rogue in heaven. If she followed his will perfectly on earth, then that's not going to change. But B, and I think this is what they lose, Robert, the more that God delegates to his creature, the more glory it brings God and the more sanctification and beauty it brings to us. And so it's a positive when we have participation, when Mary participates in the distribution of graces, when Mary participates in the redemption. That can't be denied either. You've got the same laundry list from Leo XIII and even Pius IX before him that talk about Our Lady's unique role participating in the acquisition of graces. Father Serafine, who we both know, Serafino Lanzetta, gave a very nice paper at this London conference on the unique sharing of Our Lady in the one priesthood of Jesus. Now, she's not an ordained priest. End of that discussion. But she participates in the acquisition of the graces upon which all post-Calvary priesthood depends. And so that's another indication of her co-redemption. But again, I think so much of it is this new, and I say Protestant, not to be sarcastic or a negative, but it really is a Lutheran metaphysic, a Lutheran method to use the sola concept rather than the participation concept. And I think that's the problem with many of these directions and why some of these statements come out, like the statement that came out saying, Mary has no mediation in the distribution of graces when three centuries of Pope says she does.
Yes, exactly. And then it qualifies that somewhat to this DDF document by citing Lumen Gentium 62 in her participation in the one mediation, but that needs further elaboration. This is why a papal definition would be so helpful to say, what do we really believe? Because there's some people who don't even want to call Mary mediatrix. And there were some even at Vatican II, some bishops, cardinals, said, let's avoid that term. It's kind of be misunderstood. But it was insisted upon, and thanks be to God, it's there in Lumen Gentium 62. But I mean, the idea of co-redemption is so simple. Mary is the new Eve. Mm-hmm. Eve collaborated with Adam in our ruin. This is what Father Roschini brings out. What does the term co-redemptrix of the human race mean? It means that just as Eve cooperated with Adam in our ruin, so Mary, the new Eve, cooperated with Christ in our redemption. Yeah. It's simple as that. Thomas Aquinas said that if Eve had sinned and not Adam, there would not have been the passing on of original sin, because Adam was the head of the human race. But Eve was the one who cooperated in the sin. She sinned first. Yeah. And so look at Mary's cooperation in bringing to us the Redeemer.
And this is so ancient, Robert. I mean, New Eve, 180 AD, three continents, Irenaeus. Many think it was apostolic, John, Polycarp, to Irenaeus. And this is not some novelty. This is the New Eve. Newman is so strong on this too. St. Cardinal Henry Newman, about the New Eve is it's a unanimous apostolic teaching that comes forward. Well, co-redemptrix is just another name for New Eve. You want to say New Adam and New Eve, or you want to say Redeemer and co-redemptrix? They're parallel. This idea that Mary's taking something away from Jesus, I don't know, Robert. Yes, it's always important to clarify in general, because that's the mother would want that first. But once we clarify it, to have to keep going back to that as if the mother's trying to steal some merit, or as if the popes are assigning Mary something that belongs to Jesus. This again is that divisive competition mentality that doesn't reflect not only the papal tradition, but also the mystical tradition. Now, the papal tradition is first, clear. But, you know, statements like what Jesus and Mary say to St. Bridget, "My son and I redeemed the human race together as if with one heart." You know, that Bernard and Bernard's disciple, who talks so strongly about Arnold of Chartres, about, you know, there's two altars, the body of Jesus, the heart of Mary. They do it together. Why do we have a problem with understanding that Jesus and Mary did it together? That doesn't mean they did it equally. It means God wanted a woman involved because a woman was involved in the loss as well.
That's correct. And some people object to the title co-redemptrix because they say, well, it communicates equality when you use co. But we never call Jesus co-redeemer. This is what Father Agustin Jimenez brings out in an email recently. You know, Jesus is not called the co-redeemer with Mary. He is the redeemer. She's with the redeemer, you know, in a subordinate way. And sometimes we use, you know, co sometimes means equal, but in this context, it clearly doesn't. I mean, when you and I are parents, we don't say parents are co-creators, that we're equal to God. Mm-hmm. It means we cooperated with God through the bodies he gave us in bringing forth new life, but on the immortal soul comes from God, you know, the source of life. So, but we cooperated with God in bringing forth children.
And this is St. Paul, we're co-workers with God. That's a straight up reference. I mean, there's several co-words that St. Paul and St. John use. And there's, you know, there's even references of saving, where Paul talks about, you know, husbands being able to save wives and wives being able to save husbands, and leaders, disciples being able to save people. Does that mean it's equality? I mean, that the univocal idea that the word has only one meaning has never been Catholic. No. Now, Moses came down with the tablets and said, yeah, here's your 5,000 words. They only mean one thing. That's one thing. But he didn't come down with tablets that said that. And since that, we use analogy and participation. And without analogy and participation, Robert, I don't know how one does Catholic theology, or really, quite frankly, and more importantly, how one lives Catholic life. Because you and I, through our prayers and sufferings, help to save souls. We don't obtain the graces, but we help in the mysterious release of graces. That's direct from Pius the 12th in Mystici Corporis, 1943, and Salvi Vitularis, John Paul II. So we do participate in redemption.
Exactly. That's why St. John Paul II several times spoke to the sick. He said, if you unite your sufferings to those of the Passion, can you not be co-redeemers of humanity? And as we know, Benedict the 16th at Fatima 2010, you know, spoke to the sick and said, you know, the same idea of uniting our sufferings with the Passion. And he said, you could be redeemers in the Redeemer.
Not even co-words, right.
Yes. So
yeah, right.
You know, this idea of solus Christus, sola fide, sola gratia. I mean, there's elements of truth in them in the strict sense, but look at the life of faith. There's mediation all over the place with the sacraments. Why do we need the Mass? Why do we need the priest is necessary. He's mediating, you know, he serves as a mediator of bringing forth the great gift of the Eucharist. I mean, he lends his voice to that of Christ. So mediation is so central to the Catholic life.
And ultimately, Robert, does that not give more glory to Christ the high priest, to Christ the one mediator? I mean, that's what gives him glory, is when it's spread and creatures freely choose to participate in it. Look, more glory for him, more sanctification for us. That's called a win-win. And so, you know, And getting back to this issue of co-redemptrix mediatrix advocate, the mother suffers for humanity, the mother nourishes humanity in the order of grace, the mother pleads for humanity. These are not just ivory tower concepts. And maybe we could bring the discussion to the issue of, you know, yay or nay regarding a definition. You know, what are positive points? And I want to bring up the major negative objection that's been predominant for the last 25 years, which is that to do such would be against the church's mission of ecumenism. But before we get to that, let's talk about the positive dimensions. I mean, historically, there's been three elements that have led to dogmas. Support theological foundations, of which doctrine already guarantees. Secondly, ecclesiastical support, so support from the bishops, although not technically necessary, as you well point out. The popes often ask for consultation or at least petitions from the bishops help. And then thirdly, the vox populi, you know, petitions from the faithful. Both Pius IX and Pius XII, in their respective defining bulls, thanked the people for their petitions. We got to remember the popes appreciate, and especially at this moment of synodality, you would think that the presence of 8 million petitions for this definition would speak volumes when the church at this very moment is trying to become more of a synodal church. Well, that's 8 million. I mean, and quite frankly, Robert, that number is a diminutive number compared to what happened before 1993 and what happened after 1998. That's really 8 million petitions in 5 years. So, yeah. These are the dimensions that have led to past definitions. And what we're seeing presently is, you know, on June 12th, I presented the Holy Father with a list of a little over 680 cardinals and bishops who have petitioned him and popes before him for the definition. The full number is far beyond that. Cardinal Gagnon, who was a dear friend and a saintly man, said he had brought hundreds of bishops' letters to Cardinal Ratzinger before the Vox Populi movement began in 1993. Cardinal Mercier, back from 1915 to 1918, brought 300 bishops' endorsements back there. So even doing that tolling, you're probably closer to 12 to 1500, not to count anything from 1920 to 1993. So I think we're talking about a very significant number of bishops who have petitioned for this definition, as well as the theological foundations, as well as record-breaking petitions from the faithful.
Exactly. And, you know, one objection to the definition, which I think you've handled very well, is the claim that it was dependent upon these apparitions at Amsterdam, where Our Lady said it's the will of the Holy Trinity to define this dogma under these three titles. And this has been spread by it's public knowledge. Father Perello wrote an article in Italian on making this claim. Why is this inaccurate?
For so many reasons. In fact, unfortunately, the reason I had to somewhat take respectfully Father Perello to task is that he did some rather scandalous statements against the visionary, as if she herself, without an ounce of evidence, that she herself was influenced by this false apparition of in Canada, which you've yourself written a piece on, this Army of Mary, which was a false version. Again, Robert, it's the benefit of history. This happens all the time. I mean, there were 10 false visionaries at Lourdes between the 14th and 16th apparitions at Lourdes, where the mother comes, the adversary comes too. But more foundationally, the movement for a fifth Marian dogma in no sense even started at Amsterdam, even though I personally think that Amsterdam is authentic. We follow the December 30th, 2020 statement, which says that the messages are not to be distributed as authentic, but the devotion continues, the prayer, etc. Notwithstanding, this movement for a definition started 30 years before Amsterdam even existed. It's also interesting that the Dutch bishops in 1943 consecrated Holland to our Blessed Mother using the titles Co-Redemptrix, Mediatrix, and Advocate 2 years before the reported apparitions of Amsterdam even began. So it is in no sense dependent on the apparitions, and even the Vox Populi movement, which is the kind of a returning to the Mercier petition in 1993. I felt called to do that after a discussion with Cardinal Gagnon in Rome, a table with my family, when he talked about how he himself had been giving petitions to Cardinal Ratzinger from bishops. And we decided that it would be a good thing to reinstate that movement without any knowledge of Amsterdam at all. I didn't even know about the Amsterdam reported apparitions. So on so many accounts, unfortunately, Father Perella's article, and I think Father Jimenez in this book coming out does a great job of identifying these errors, and really something that would, in a public publication, would be guilty of calumny and possible even lawsuits, the attack, and even, you know, personal attacks, which I'm not so concerned about. But attacking the visionary after she's long dead, who was buried by the bishop with a great sense of honor and reverence, that's inappropriate, but absolutely no foundation that the Amsterdam apparitions are the foundation or the continuation of the movement for the Fifth Marian dogma.
Exactly, exactly. And it, you know, the one objection has been that, well, Vatican II didn't use this, the title. It used mediatrix, but in a very modified way. But maybe you could respond to that, because in the praenotanda, or introductory remarks to the 62 draft, which would become Lumen Gentium 8, it said certain terms and expressions have been omitted, which, although most true in themselves, would present difficulty of understanding by the separated brethren, in this case, the Protestants. So these are, and one of them was co-redemptrix of the human race. So it was recognized at Vatican II as most true in itself.
Yeah, absolutely true in itself was the expression. And the irony is it never got to the Council Fathers, Robert. A theological commission took it out of the schema before the Council Fathers ever had an opportunity to even discuss it, let alone vote on it. And I think that, you know, prudentially is unfortunate, because subcommittees of theologians are not guided by the Spirit necessarily. They're certainly not guided by the Spirit as successors of the apostles are. And so when co-redemptrix was removed by a subcommittee of theologians before it ever got to the fathers, that is the bishops, I think that's unfortunate. It's also important to note that in the request for what they wanted to discuss at the Second Vatican Council before the bishops went to Rome, one of the two predominant requests was a definition of Our Lady as either co-redemptrix or as mediatrix of all graces. And then St. John the 23rd decided that there would not be any new dogmatic proclamations at Vatican II of any sort. So as soon as the Holy Father, and we have to trust the Holy Father's discernment with that, but as soon as the Holy Father made that statement, the possibility of the Fifth Marian dogma being defined at Vatican II was now over. So to quote that as saying, well, if it should have been defined, it should have been defined at Vatican II, that again, quite frankly, is an ignorance of history, because there was a very significant petition for defining the assumption at Vatican I.
Yes,
it was chosen. It was decided that things were not ripe. Well, then what happened? It was defined in 1950. So the idea that if it wasn't defined at Vatican II, it shouldn't be defined later, again, would just be an unfortunate ignorance of history.
And I mean, in the 16th century, the King of Spain, with the support of so many Spanish bishops, wanted the definition of the Immaculate Conception back in the late 16th century. What the Pope decided in 1617 was to forbid writings attacking the Immaculate Conception. And that was in 1617, but it wasn't until 1854 that the dogma was proclaimed. So sometimes these things go in steps, and God's timing is not always our timing. I mean, at the Council of Trent, in the decree on original sin, it's not the intent of the council to include Mary under original sin, but it stopped short of affirming her as immaculately conceived. But it wasn't going to take the other side. So it wasn't the time. And, right. and it developed in gradual steps, and the popes more and more showed support for the Immaculate Conception. So I think something similar might be happening here. John Paul II, as you know, was quite open to the dogma. But then there were certain people who counseled him against this.
Yes, that's unfortunately true. I mean, the Holy Father, I mean, I've had four bishops independently tell me that the Holy Father was open to this definition. There were just, let's say, cardinals, certain prominent cardinals that had to be convinced of it. Now, technically, the Holy Father, John Paul, could have done it on his own, but he sought to respect the counsel that was coming from one of his prefects. Now, that's, again, if you want to get a post-conciliar idea of these titles, you got to go to St. John Paul II as the authoritative interpreter of the council. If John Paul II uses co-redemptrix 6 times, mediatrix of all graces 9 times, advocate dozens of times, well, then he's, as the vicar of Christ, the ultimate interpreter of the council. That can tell you very clearly the council is not against that. I know for a fact that the Holy Father intended to make this definition. He got so much opposition from 2 cardinals in petition, in particular, they chose not to. But that's for later Vatican archives release to come down, because I was asked to do some writing on that during in 1997 when the Holy Father was sending a message to Poland. So again, the reality is appropriateness has to be discerned. I'm very happy to articulate why I think now is the right time for a definition. I think things have come forward. I think the doctrine is mature. The doctrine has been taught by popes for centuries. There's 20 volumes of theological writings that defend this. Even back when there were commissions instituted by Pius the 11th in Belgium, in Spain, and in Rome, just the Spanish Commission alone produced over 2,000 pages of support for this definition. The Belgian Commission also came out in support. The as we know, the Roman Commission never came out. Father Garrigou Lagrange was on that commission. He was certainly in favor, but it appears that one man, Cardinal, the Secretary of State at the time, a French cardinal, was opposed to this. But in terms of the theological foundations, it's there. I have to say this too, Robert. I think that theology should not be bereft or dismissive of political current events. And I think the situation in the world right now really calls for an advocate sooner rather than later. And by that, I mean this. I believe a solemn definition would release historic graces for the church and the world. Why would it release historic graces? Because it's humanity in the person of the Vicar of Christ freely acknowledging that we believe she really is the co-redemptrix, mediatrix, and advocate. Well, when that happens by the Vicar of Christ, that frees her in a sense. That gives a manifestation of human consent, which is always required. God doesn't force grace. He doesn't allow grace to be forced. But that frees her in the order of human consent to fully activate these roles on our behalf. Now, quite frankly, Cardinal Mercier started this movement during World War I because he had the same belief that a definition would bring grace to a World War I environment. Well, I think we are in a World War III piecemeal environment if we believe what Pope Francis says. And, you know, we know these headlines of what's happening with Russia and Ukraine, with Palestine and Israel, the situation with China, the Iran situation. We are in a grave, serious situation. So I almost think that the Pascal's wager really has a fair value to this discussion. That is, what if all the apparitions and what if Mercier and all the supporters are wrong? What if no grace comes out of this at all? What would you get? Well, you'd get a truth accentuated by the Vicar of Christ that Mary is truly Mother. You'd get the type of clarity you've been talking about in this program too, that we know exactly what she is, also what she wasn't, what she isn't. Cardinal O'Connor, the late Cardinal O'Connor of New York, said a definition would also clarify what Catholics don't believe about Mary. And that's true for authentic ecumenism. Exactly. So that in itself would be a victory. But what if the apparitions, what if Mercy was right, that peace depends on this proclamation of Our Lady? Well, then that should be something that stirs the heart to doing this, because I think we are in an unprecedented danger in terms of potential approximate potential to a third world war.
Yes, and why these consecrations the popes have done, John Paul II and Pope Francis, you know, to end war, appealing, consecrating the world and Russia and Ukraine to the Immaculate Heart of Mary. That's clearly an awareness of her great maternal intercessory power, which is, it could be understood as a role as advocate, but also mediatrix of all graces, which Pope Francis has affirmed the title. I wonder if in the time remaining, some people still appeal to this 1996 and published in 1997 Częstochowa Commission document. They say, well, this commission of the Pontifical Marian Academy said it's not time to have this definition.
Yeah, I'm glad you bring that up, Robert. And before we end, I also want to deal with the ecumenical question, yes, which I'll get your way as well. So very briefly, in 1996, the Częstochowa Commission, members of the commission have stated that this was not a Vatican-directed commission, that they had no pre-knowledge. There was 15 minutes of discussion. It was made up. It was the typical ecumenical gathering that happens with the Pontifical Marian Academy's conferences. So every 2 or 4 years, there would be an ecumenical section. So 6 of the 21 members were not Catholic. And so, and there was no research. There was approximately a 15 to 20 minute basic monologue by the individual that was giving the presentation. There was no discussion. And then a couple of days later, there was a statement that was written. Now, the statement didn't come out until, if I remember correctly, it was because it was while we had 70 bishops in Rome for the Vox Populi conference. So I believe that was in May. It was in September. And so 9 months later, this statement comes out, which really criticized St. John Paul II's Mariology front, back, and center. And you had references, and it was almost certainly done by Father Laurentin, who is a friend, but I strongly disagree with him on these things, saying that things like, you know, you can't call Mary the Holy Spirit you can't call Mary the advocate because the Holy Spirit is the advocate, or these terms are ambiguous. Well, none of those were substantial arguments. And in fact, it was in no sense magisterial. It was a side committee with no research, no study. Again, it was a 20-minute process. And I thank God for the people that had the courage to come forward and say, this was not a Vatican-approved or appointed commission. This was a ad hoc group, a side group, 6 of which members were not Catholic to begin with. So I think that got some unnecessary publicity, but to its benefit, it gave us the ability to answer, and I think we have answered, many theologians have answered those objections of saying, no, the titles are clear. That's why popes use them. No, you can use analogy and call the Holy Spirit advocate and Mary advocate. And ultimately, these are truths which have their foundation in the papal magisterium, not in private revelation, not just in, quote, marginal teachings by popes.
Exactly. And speaking of marginal document, marginal authority, that's what our late friend Monsignor Calkin said. Well, this document, declaration of this ad hoc committee is marginal compared to those affirmations by popes of these titles.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, yeah. What's more marginal, an ad hoc committee or official statements by the Vicar of Christ, in that case, John Paul II? I remember calling Monsignor Giewitz the moment after it came out, who was the Pope's personal secretary. And I said, have you seen this document. He said, what document? He nor the Holy Father, St. John Paul II, had any idea that this Just Jehovah Commission document came out. I said, it's critiquing the Pope's own Mariology. And then he quickly got off the phone and researched it. So this was not done. The Just Jehovah Commission had no approval by St. John Paul II. He didn't even know it had come out. And in fact, it was critiquing his own uses of co-redemptrix, mediatrix, and advocate.
Yes, one member of that ad hoc commission, we won't mention his name, but he said the whole thing was manipulated by the Secretariat of State. And we just leave that aside. But one aspect of the Just Jehovah Commission was ecumenism. They said this will have a negative effect on ecumenism. Maybe you could respond to that.
Yes, so let's talk about ecumenism. I find, Robert, the challenge is no one defines the term. So what is ecumenism? If you're talking about a kind of a broad sweep idea of trying to work for unity, that's one thing. But the best definition I've ever seen, the closer we get to a definition, is in St. John Paul II's document on ecumenism, Ut Unum Sint, his 94 document, if I remember correctly. And he says essentially that ecumenism constitutes prayer as its soul, dialogue as its body, seeking ultimate union in the one holy Catholic and Apostolic Church of Jesus Christ. And he says repeatedly in there, any doctrinal compromise is pseudo-ecumenism. And he basically said, who would think of such a thing for the sake of false commission? Well, I think people have to read that again today, because I think some people are thinking of such things, of denying true doctrines, including doctrines about Our Lady, for the sake of a superficial union. But that's a false foundation, Robert. If it's not based on authentic dogma and doctrine, it's not going to bring people back. All it's going to do is dilute what we have as Catholics. So I very much liked Cardinal Connor's, the late Cardinal Connor's letter to the Holy Father asking for the definition, saying a definition would aid ecumenism, because it would clearly state what the church teaches in its best biblical and theological formulation, what the church does teach about Our Lady and her role in the redemption, and what it does not teach, that she's not a fourth person of the Trinity, that she's not an equal redeemer, et cetera, et cetera. So if we're talking about real ecumenism, which means honest dialogue, it's interesting. I know we've talked about this before, but one friend did a research about the different ecumenical groups and meetings and papers that came out for the last 20 years. And none of them, essentially none of them, brought up the Mary question.
No, exactly. It was brought up with this Anglican Catholic dialogue, thanks be to God. But it's interesting because some people say, well, we might offend the separated brethren using these titles. Well, they already reject the Immaculate Conception. Many of them reject the Assumption. And some now reject Mother of God, even though Luther and Calvin affirmed that.
So
what are we supposed to do for ecumenism? There was one cardinal, an American cardinal well known, who had to repent of in 1978 agreeing that Eucharistic communion would not require belief in the Immaculate Conception or the Assumption. You just have to say it's not contrary to the gospel. And he wrote an article saying I was misguided.
Yeah. And Robert, ultimately, guess what else they don't accept? They don't accept the papacy. They don't accept the real presence of Jesus in the Eucharist, most of them. And so why draw the line with, you know, denying Marian truths for the sake of ecumenism? Why don't we just go full tally and start denying the papacy and infallibility and the Eucharist? We can't do that, but we can't do it for Our Lady either. That's false, as John Paul says. It's a pseudo ecumenism. And in Vatican II, in number 11 of the document on ecumenism, also talks about this very strongly. We forget about that. About the dangers of reductionism in the name of ecumenism. It's a wolf. It's not authentic and it won't serve. There won't be true unity. What about the other possibility of proclaiming the truth about Our Lady and now giving ecumenism to her, letting her use her graces, which she does mediate and does distribute, and I would hold as an instrument, as a physical instrument, and let her bring new grace towards unity between Catholic and Protestant and Orthodox traditions. That, I think, would be far more effective than denying the truth about Our Lady in whatever form it takes, and whatever congregation it takes. I think it's always a miss, a well-intended miss, but it's always a miss when you're denying Our Lady's unique participation in the life of Jesus, in the way of Jesus, in the redemption of Jesus. And therefore, you're also denying our tertiary participation in Jesus's mediation, in his redemption, and the call to advocate for each other. Because deny it about Our Lady, and you're also necessarily going to deny it about the church in general.
Exactly. And I mean, authentic ecumenism must be rooted in the truth. And the truth is what unites us all as followers of Christ. So if as we deeply believe, the Mary is co-redemptrix, she is the mediatrix of all graces, she is our maternal advocate, then we should proclaim this truth. And then she, as the mother of unity, the Mater Unitatis, will help to bring this about, because she's the mother of all, you know, of all peoples, and that includes especially the faithful. And she, as a good mother, wants to bring the followers of her son into unity. And she's their mother in the order of grace as well. So this is what hurts me, and maybe I'm sure it hurts you, is to listen to Catholics who denigrate some Catholic teachings, or sometimes it's just done through ignorance. I mean, a priest once said, you know, well, you know, this title mediatrix, you can't apply that to Mary. And he didn't even know that Vatican II had used the title. And then he doubted Mary's perpetual virginity as a dogma. So, and he was a good priest. He was just poorly trained. So this is why we need it. And as you have noted, there seems to be a turning of the tide now in these conferences in England, Scotland, in the United States, and now members of the Pontifical Marian Academy, showing a new openness to Mary's co-redemptive role.
Yeah, I think so. That's simply the case. And it was so refreshing. And I think we have to continue it. And, you know, of course, we have our various teaching responsibilities. But I want to say also to our viewers, you know, in any way that you can, teach and preach, educate, including young children, these roles of Our Lady. Help them to be familiar with this. I got a wonderful response. Actually, it was a video from a priest in Medjugorje who preached for the anniversary mass. And you can have your own opinion on Medjugorje. I personally believe it to be authentic, but you can do your own discernment. But that on the anniversary, he preached. His homily was on Mary's co-redemptrix, mediatrix of all graces, and advocate. That's such a positive thing that we break borders in terms of speaking about the truth about Our Lady and also encouraging prayer for this definition. I personally believe, again, it's got to make their own call. I think there's something prophetic, and I think there's something imminent about a definition that will bring grace to humanity. I think humanity is going down a very challenging path. And even in what, you know, technically the DDF, Robert, did not affirm, it didn't approve Rosa Mystica because it can't based on its own new definition, but it did, you know, say there's nothing against faith and morals. Well, there's also a very strong apocalyptic message in Rosa Mystica and very strong things about Judas priests. And I mean, it's a strong message as well, but like the rest of the Marian message of the modern world, it talks about significant challenges ahead where we could very much benefit from the full intercessory power of Our Lady. So I encourage people to preach and teach and pray for this definition according to the, you know, the discernment of your individual conscience.
I'm convinced it would really help the church. And it would really help Mariology and the knowledge of the faithful, especially some priests. I've been teaching at a seminary for a quarter of a century, and I try to communicate the truth. And it's the seminarians don't oppose the truth, but it's some colleagues. And maybe your son, John Mark, who teaches at a seminary, could affirm this too. Sometimes it's without any ill intent, but it's just that they had poor training after Vatican II in Mariology.
Yeah, John Mark, who teaches at Mount St. Mary's, the seminaries are very receptive of this. And Robert, you know, we've talked about this before. I've taught almost 6,000 students at Franciscan University in 38 years. Rarely in all that time did I ever have a single objection. There'd be a question on occasion, but my major question in talking about Mary's Corredentrix Mediatrix Advocate and a Fifth Marian Dogma, the question is, why has this not already happened? Yeah. The young people respond to this very quickly because they know we're supposed to be co-redeemers on our own level, and we're supposed to mediate, and we're supposed to pray for each other. So they don't have a difficulty. There's not blocks. But as you say, yes, it tends to be the older crowd, so to speak, with a formation that I think was lacking, maybe perhaps right after the council, that have kind of knee-jerk reactions to this. But again, what they're really rejecting is participation, analogy, things that are absolutely essential for Catholic theology, and ultimately a powerful role for Our Lady. And, you know, I want to end my comments with the simplicity of Mother Teresa's letter, which she wrote when I went down to visit her in Calcutta. It was actually the feast of St. Maximin Kolbe on August 14th of 1993. And in typical simplistic but profound fashion, and paraphrasing her letter, she says, you know, Mary is the co-redemptrix with Jesus because she gave Jesus his body and suffered with him at the foot of the cross. Mary is the mediatrix of all graces because she brings the graces of Jesus to all of us. Mary is our advocate who comes and brings the needs of humanity to Jesus. The papal definition of Mary as co-redemptrix, mediatrix, and advocate will bring great graces to the church. God bless you, M. Teresa, MC. And I think that says it all. The titles, the clarity, and that'll bring great graces. And therefore, I couldn't be more in favor of it.
Yes, and in Father Agustin Jimenez's book, which is going to be published, his bishop now has endorsed it with a preface, and he cites Mother Teresa's letter to you in that book. I mean, it's most significant. These great saints, Padre Pio, St. Padre Pio, St. Maximilian Kolbe, the saints see it, and then, of course, St. John Paul II saw it. He was held back by some cardinals, we don't need to name them, pursuing this. But, you know, God is more powerful than even cardinals. And the Blessed Mother is too. And if it's the will of God and the will of the Blessed Mother, it will happen. We just have to do our part.
That's right.
To explain the truth and to pray for the changing of hearts and minds of members of the hierarchy, and to be more open to this. And we've seen, you know, with Pope Francis affirming the doctrine of Marian co-redemption, he's hesitant about new dogmas and the title, but he's affirmed explicitly in one message, Mary is mediatrix of all graces and the advocate close to Jesus.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
So he's, two out of the three titles he absolutely affirms. We just have to pray that if you understand co-redemption as somehow challenging Christ as the redeemer of humanity, reject it. But it means with the redeemer, with and under, but according to God's will, essential to his plan.
That's right. That's right. And ultimately, that's the call. The call is, what is the will of God? Did he want a woman involved in the restoration like a woman was involved in the laws? The answer is yes. And that's unanimous. Everybody grants that. All the fathers grant it. All the popes grant it. Proclaiming it will only bring greater clarity and greater grace to the world. So, well, thank you, Robert. Very enjoyable masterclass here. And for you viewers, if you find this helpful, feel free to pass it on as well. We will continue this masterclass in Mariology, trying to take perhaps a little bit more depth these classic Mariological truths, because ultimately Our Lady is so worth it. It's both for truth, but it's also for love, and the mother deserves the best. So thanks for being with us. Thanks again, Robert, for your invaluable role in the masterclass, and God bless you all.